From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The fact that, you know, you go to any prison in the United States and you will see people doing, you know, young kids doing 10 and 20 and 30 year sentences for selling ounces of cocaine, when the men who made the whole problem possible, these international cocaine brokers, were in, you know, in the case of the men that I found, were working working with the DEA, working for the DEA, on the DEA payroll. At the same time, they were flooding the streets of America with drugs. And
from Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
You have to understand that the word Americans doesn't refer to Americans. Americans refers to the constituency of the New York Times, the people who they meet in elegant restaurants and executive suites and editorial offices and so on. That's Americans. And they're prosperous and smug, and they have boundless expectations, and for them it's a fairy tale economy.
Shattering the fairy tales, America's leading dissident Noam Chomsky speaks out on the myth of a strong U.S. economy, and we speak to an Indonesian activist who escaped Indonesia after being tortured by Suharto soldiers. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Indonesia sent armored personnel carriers into the streets of the capital today as thousands continue to demonstrate against the dictator Suharto's grip on power. Up to 20 people were reported killed. The U.S. Embassy urged American citizens to defer non-essential travel to Indonesia and is evacuating family members of embassy staff. Japan and France also cautioned their citizens to stay away. Witnesses said five men were wounded by gunfire. Others said they saw two men shot to death and three others injured in one downtown street today. The house of Indonesia's richest man, Lim Soe Leong, an ethnic Chinese billionaire with close links to Suharto, was reportedly trashed and burned. The headquarters of the Social Affairs Department, headed by Suharto's oldest daughter, Cabinet Minister Siti Haryanti Rukmana, was also gutted by fire. This according to the Associated Press. Suharto left Cairo early yesterday. Meanwhile, the Clinton administration is saying that it has almost no remaining diplomatic leverage with the government of Indonesia to stem the growing violence there. It's decided to dispatch a high-level military delegation to demand that the security forces end their attacks on civilian demonstrators, this according to U.S. officials. They said the delegation of military officers, which is being led by Admiral Joseph Pruer, the commander of all American military forces in the Pacific, is scheduled to travel to Indonesia today to warn their Indonesian counterparts in blunt terms that the country could face collapse without restraint by the armed forces. The official said that Admiral Pruer would make that what one described as a soldier-to-soldier appeal for restraint to General Wiranto, the chief of the 400,000-strong Indonesian armed forces. The Indonesian security forces killed at least six students at an elite private college in Jakarta on Tuesday. It's interesting that the U.S. is talking about Indonesian military using restraint when it was just exposed in the Nation magazine that the Pentagon was secretly training Indonesian soldiers in, among other issues, urban warfare. This news from Geneva. Major powers, including China and the United States, lashed out at India at U.N.-sponsored talks on disarmament on Thursday, saying its nuclear tests had brought a new threat to South Asia. Pakistan's ambassador kicked off the attacks on its arch foe with a blistering 30-minute speech at the conference on disarmament. Nearly 30 countries addressed the world's sole negotiating forum on disarmament, which also heard India's envoy defend its five underground blasts this week. Japan, Britain, Germany, New Zealand, Australia, and Mexico were among the countries that criticized India. Iran was also due to speak. Cuban leader Fidel Castro, who could cross paths with President Bill Clinton in Geneva on Monday, said Thursday the United States had tried to follow a policy of genocide against the country. The effort to carry out genocide against our people made us multiply our efforts and our desire to survive. This he told the Assembly of the United Nations World Health Organization, clearly referring to the 36-year U.S. embargo on Cuba. And the 71-year-old Castro arrived yesterday for his week-long stay in Switzerland, making his remark at the end of a speech in which he also said extreme free market liberalism was a threat to the planet's poor and its environment. Next Tuesday, he's to address the special meeting of the World Trade Organization celebrating the 50th anniversary of the founding of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, known as GATT, the motor of the opening of global markets since 1948. Clinton is to make an evening visit to Geneva Monday to address the WTO, of which Cuba was a founder member. Castro said Wednesday he would have nothing against a meeting of the two. The Senate Finance Committee considered using part of the money that would be raised from an increase in cigarette taxes to give a tax break to self-employed workers and workers whose employers do not pay for medical insurance. And this news from Jerusalem. A Palestinian laborer was stabbed to death in an Orthodox Jewish neighborhood in Jerusalem in what the police said was apparently an act of revenge for the fatal stabbing of a yeshiva student last week. And finally, the European Parliament agreed to gradually phase out tobacco advertising and tobacco sponsorship across the 15-nation European Union. The move will abolish almost all tobacco advertising by the year 2006. Most tobacco advertising will be illegal within 4 years. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Noam Chomsky is widely considered to be the leading dissident intellectual in this country. His research and information over the years have proved irrefutable. In all his writings since the Vietnam War, Chomsky has never once retracted a single piece of information. Yet you seldom, if ever, see him debating the finest minds in Washington on any major networks. He's almost never invited on National Public Radio or even on public broadcasting, PBS. Undaunted, Chomsky goes on churning out books faster than any other political writer in this country. To have Chomsky's most recent information is like an empowerment boost for those in the struggle for justice. Well, today on Democracy Now!, we want to bring you one of Noam Chomsky's most recent talks on the fairy tale of the booming economy in this country. The talk is entitled Whose World Order? Conflicting Visions. He gave it at Purdue University just a few weeks ago.
I want to say some things about the way the world is, the way we're taught the world is. And then about the way most people experience the world here, and even more so in countries that aren't as rich and full of advantages as this one. And then talk about why, how come it things turn out like this, and towards the end, what are some of the plans that are now being laid, mostly in secrecy, to enhance a process which is quite injurious to the large majority of the people of the United States, and even more so elsewhere, which is why they're kept secret. Well, how is the world presented to us? We don't have to spend much time on this because you hear it all day and every day. I'll just take one example from the New York Times newspaper of record, a lead story in the Sunday Times last week. The headline is by one of their leading correspondents. The headline reads, America is prosperous and smug. Americans, goes on to say, Americans have boundless confidence, expectations of unlimited economic success. They're living in the happy glow of an American boom, a fairy tale U.S. expansion since 1991 under the direction of the man who the international financial press christens the saintly Alan Greenspan, with due reverence. Well, that's sort of, that's the way things are supposed to be. Okay, you can ask yourself whether they are. Let's have a look at the way they are, beginning with the happy glow of the American boom and the fairy tale expansion. Well, it certainly has been a fairy tale for some sectors of the population, namely the business world. In fact, the story that I just quoted actually gives one example of the fairy tale economy, namely the stock market. And it's true that asset inflation is going through the roof and concerning plenty of economists. And that's a real benefit to the 1% of the population who own, of households who own half the stock, roughly comparable figures for other assets, or the even the top 10% who own about 90% of them. If you throw in pension funds, you get a little redistribution of figures among the top fifth. For the rest of the population, it's essentially irrelevant. It's also pretty much irrelevant for the economy. That's another story. But for them, it's certainly been a fairy tale, especially the top 1%. In fact, it's been a fairy tale for the business world altogether. So year after year, you have reports of what they call a dazzling, stupendous profit growth, breaking all records. The problems, the read Business Week, you find out that the problems that the business world faces are things like what to do with all that cash as surging profits are overflowing the coffers of corporate America with liquid assets of non-financial institutions, corporations reaching a staggering two-thirds of $1 trillion, which is causing vexing problems for Boeing and Intel and General Electric and other suffering corporations. For them, undoubtedly, it's a fairy tale. Looking at the rest of us, the fairy tale expansion since 1991 is, in fact, the weakest recovery of the post-war period, post-Second World War period. It's even below the quite anemic growth rates of the 1980s and the 1970s, and well below the historical average since the Civil War, in fact, the worst one on record. That's the fairy tale growth rate. If you look at per capita economic growth and you rank the United States among the OECD countries, the 29 rich countries, it's about average, actually slightly below average in per capita economic growth in the 90s. Picked up a little the last couple of quarters, but in general, not only unusually slow growth, but unusually slow growth of productivity, which is a predictor for the future. That's the fairy tale economy. So how come, it does raise a question, how could we have stupendous profit growth when the fairy tale expansion is the weakest since World War II? Well, there's actually a pretty simple answer to that. For approximately two-thirds of the population, hourly wages have either stagnated or declined in the last 20 years. Working hours are going up, wages are going down. The average wage is probably 15% lower than it was in the mid-70s. Entry-level wages, first job, they collapsed during the 1980s. They went down by about 30%. You read and economists tell you, well, this is only unskilled workers, but then small footnote, the definition of unskilled workers is about 75% of the workforce. In the late 1980s, which was a period of weak recovery, better than this one, but still some kind of recovery, during the latter half of the 1980s, hunger in the United States went up by 50%, reached 30 million people. You go back to around 1980, the United States was more or less average in a, like other industrial countries by measures like, say, child poverty or malnutrition, infant mortality, a percentage of the population in prison, inequality, other standard quality of life measures. By the end of the 1980s, it was far in the lead, and it's going still farther in the lead by such measures, if lead is the right word. During the 1980s, industrial accidents on the job doubled. illegal firing of union organizers tripled in the 1980s, along with a whole host of other violations of labor laws. The Reagan administration, in effect, informed the business world that it simply wasn't going to enforce the laws. They could be on the books if you want, but they weren't going to enforce them. And advantage was taken of that. Again, you can read about it in Business Week, which described it quite accurately. That's continuing under Clinton. That's a big factor in the rising inequality, in the attack on wages, on incomes. And in fact, it's kind of recognized in the business pages of the New York Times, not the, you know, the lead stories of the kind I read, where they describe what they call a treadmill economy in which most people are going nowhere fast with quite poor prospects because of such factors as unusually low productivity growth, low entry-level wages, and so on. Well, what about the boundless confidence of the smug, prosperous Americans? Well, you can learn about that from the New York Times, too. There's another front-page story with the title Rehabilitation of Mourning in America. You know, Mourning in America was the slogan that Reagan speechwriters gave him when he's riding off into the sunset and imitating John Wayne or something. So now there's a rehabilitation of mourning in America. And the story goes on to explain that things are really looking up, you know, contrary to the doomsayers with all their boring statistics about hungry children and wage decline and all that kind of nonsense. The story does concede that, I'm quoting it now, things are looking up mostly for the well-off and successful. People like Jerry Jasinowski, who's the head of the National Association of Manufacturers, who's quoted liberally right through the story, in fact, the main person quoted. But then it says, the story says, it's not just the well-off and successful, even the millions who are suffering appear to be helping reestablish what Mr. Jasinowski considers the right priorities as their expectations have diminished. So they're pretty well off too. Of course, the right priorities for the business world are a little different. I mean, there they are, surging profits, overflowing the coffers of corporate America and causing vexing problems and so on. The story quotes the head of the University of Michigan Research Center, which is the main center that kind of monitors public opinion regularly. He says, it's like people are saying, I'm not earning enough to get by, but it's not as bad as it could be. While before the Reagan-Clinton economic miracle, people had old-fashioned ideas about getting by. So it's morning in America. Americans are prosperous and smug with boundless confidence and so on. What is all this about? Well, it actually makes perfect sense if you understand how to read English. You have to understand that the word Americans doesn't refer to Americans. Americans refers to the constituency of the New York Times, the people who they meet in elegant restaurants and executive suites and editorial offices and so on. That's Americans, and they're prosperous and smug, and they have boundless expectations, and for them it's a fairy tale economy. And if there's other sort of two-legged creatures out there, they have to establish the right priorities, which are, well, you know, could be worse, and, you know, maybe I'm not getting by, but don't have any expectations, even as things get worse and worse. That's what's called a healthy economy, a fairy tale economy, and from a certain point of view, it is. Let's take a look at the saintly Alan Greenspan, who presided over the fairy tale economy in the 1990s. He testified about it to the Senate Banking Committee about a year ago. He was very proud of his achievement, and he explained it. He attributed the miracle to what he called greater worker insecurity, meaning workers are intimidated. They're afraid to ask for a living wage or for benefits, and that's a good thing. That contributes to what's called the health of the economy. That's it. Health of the economy is a term kind of like Americans. It doesn't mean what the words seem to indicate. It's a technical term. Which refers to making sure the Americans are smug and prosperous, whatever it comes to the population. health of the economy is a term that's uncorrelated with the health of the economy, even the, you know, literal health of the population. So these are good things, you know, that's what we should hope for, so naturally we're proud, workers are nice and intimidated and so on. The economic report of the president, which comes out every year, described pretty much the same things in sort of more muted terms. They also took pride, the Clinton administration took pride in the fairy tale boom, and they attributed it to significant wage restraint, which they say results from changes in labor market institutions and practices, which are not detailed. But they include things like, for example, not enforcing the laws about illegal strike breaking, or not enforcing OSHA regulations, safety and health regulations, which accounts for the sharp rise in industrial accidents and so on. So that's change in labor market institutions and practices. There are other changes. The United States, one of the major ones is the use of what are called permanent replacement workers, which is a step worse than strike breakers. That's impermissible in any industrial country. In fact, the United States has been censured by the International Labor Organization for resorting to this practice. You should realize that the ILO very rarely criticizes its main funders. So this was quite unusual. When the U.S. was censured, I think it was 1992, there were two industrial countries that allowed permanent replacement workers, the United States and South Africa. I think South Africa is now off the boat with the unfortunate changes that have taken place there in the last couple of years. So that means the United States is probably alone in this respect, which wouldn't be too surprising. The United States also has the worst record in Europe and the Western Hemisphere in ratifying ILO labor conventions on labor rights. If you're really a stickler, you ought to catch me on that. It actually has the third worst record, Lithuania.
You're listening to Professor Noam Chomsky of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology giving a recent speech at Purdue University in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We'll come back to him in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! To Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with the speech of Professor Noam Chomsky, given just a few weeks ago at Purdue University in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Noam Chomsky, Professor of Linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Now take a look at the Caterpillar strike that just ended with a big defeat for working people. Caterpillar did resort to the permanent replacement workers option, but also to other things. Caterpillar, like other major corporations, other Americans, in the special sense of the press, Caterpillar enjoyed dazzling profits. It was part of the huge profit boom, and it used the profits not for economic growth, but for excess production, for creation of excess capacity abroad. That doesn't contribute to, you know, economic health in the ordinary sense. But it does contribute to class warfare, and it makes good sense for that reason. If you have excess capacity abroad, then if working people in Illinois strike, you can fill your, you know, fill the orders for your markets by using super exploited cheap labor abroad that you've got available thanks to the excess capacity that you've created a result of the dazzling profits. So that's a good way of attacking American workers. And that, again, contributes to the health of the economy and the fairy tale boom and so on. The general fact is that capital is extremely mobile now. It wasn't always. I'll come back to why it is so mobile. But labor obviously isn't. Furthermore, the links among working people are extremely weak. There have been major attacks on the unions, even within countries. But the international links are weak, and to confront coordinated, concentrated, tyrannical structures with enormous resources is very difficult, particularly when they're backed by powerful states and by huge secret bureaucracies like the IMF, which are devoted to their interests and so on. It's an unequal struggle, unless it is equalized and changed, the future, at least for democracy and human rights, doesn't look so great. Another change in labor market institutions and practices results from the trade agreements, the mislabeled free trade agreements. So take, say, NAFTA. NAFTA is an investor rights agreement. It's not a free trade agreement. It has some wording about labor rights and environmental rights, but they're basically toothless. They were put in to get people to shut up. They're not completely vacuous. Under NAFTA rules, it's possible for workers to bring complaints about illegal labor practices. And in fact, some did so. Telecommunication workers brought a complaint under NAFTA. They actually won, but the corporation got a tap on the wrist a couple of years later. It didn't amount to anything. But one side effect of it was that there was a study done under NAFTA rules about the role of NAFTA in strike breaking in the United States. It was done by a labor historian at Cornell University, Kate Bronfenbrenner, published under NAFTA, suppressed by the Clinton administration, but released by Canada and Mexico. Her conclusion is that I think the Clinton administration finally released it after a delay, not that you'd know anything about it by reading the press. According to her study, about half of organizing efforts since NAFTA have been disrupted by threats to transfer. That means things like putting up a trailer outside a plant where people are trying to organize with a sign that says, Mexican transfer job or something like that. And these threats are not idle. When organizing efforts nevertheless succeed, there have been closures at triple the rate, the pre-NAFTA rate, so they're meaningful threats. Of course, it's all illegal. All such efforts in strike breaking are illegal, but remember, that's a technicality. Since the Reagan administration and now the Clinton administration have essentially informed the business world that you don't have to worry about laws because we're not going to enforce them. Crime pays, in other words, with state protection. Well, that's a sample of some of the benign changes in labor market institutions and practices that leads to significant wage restraint and gives us a fairy tale economy for Americans who are smug and prosperous. All you have to do is translate the words a little and you go from propaganda to reality quite easily. The saintly Allen also gives public talks. He gave one recently to the newspaper editors' meeting in the United States. Interesting talk, worth reading. It's full of passionate rhetoric about the miracles of the market, the wonders that are brought about by consumer choice and all these magnificent things. And he even gave examples, which is nice. His examples are the internet, computers, information processing, satellites, and transistors, a couple of others. Now, those are kind of interesting examples of the miracles of the market and consumer choice, because as any, even the most ignorant economist knows, those are textbook examples of creativity and production in the state sector, in the public sector, picked up later by the business world, given to them as gifts after the work's been done. So take, say, the internet, which is a stellar example. That was developed for 30 years within the Pentagon. And then the National Science Foundation. and just a year or two ago was handed over to private corporations. So now, you know, Bill Gates is real interested in the internet. For the 30 years that it was being developed, private business had no interest. Gates wouldn't even go to a conference on the internet 2 or 3 years ago. I have to say, he is honest about it. He has attributed his success to his ability to, I'm quoting him, to embrace and expand the ideas of others, most of which come from your pocketbook, incidentally. The internet is almost a classic example. Take computers, you know, kind of the core of a modern industrial society. Same story. In the 1950s, they were unmarketable, so the public paid for the research and development under the cover of an air defense system and other such things. When they advanced to the point where you could sell them, they were handed over to private corporations, some of them spin-offs from the military project. That's why IBM isn't making typewriters anymore, and so on for a whole bunch of others. But the public contribution remained, and in the 1980s particularly, it went up with new developments in advanced computer technology and so on. That's computers. It's the same story with information processing, satellites, too obvious to comment. The one example that he mentioned that where you could claim that there's a private sector contribution in the crucial research and development stage is transistors. So that one's worth looking at. The others aren't even a joke. This one is at least a joke, which is what it is. Transistors were, in fact, invented in a private laboratory, Bell Labs, in 1947. But what was the role of the market and consumer choice in that? Well, the answer is zero, because Bell Labs was the laboratory of AT&T, which was a government-supported monopoly. So there's no consumer choice and no market. Since it was a monopoly, it was able to charge monopoly prices, which is, in effect, a tax on the public. And through taxing the public, it was able to establish a very good laboratory. Bell Labs was a fine lab, where they invented transistors and solar cells and information theory and radio astronomy, all kinds of work. It was a great lab. I used to go there in the 50s. As soon as the monopoly was broken, Bell Labs went down the tube because the public wasn't paying for it anymore. So no more Bell Labs. But it's true that in 1947, a government-supported monopoly was able to use indirect taxation to develop transistors. However, that's not the end of the story. The development of transistors was based on wartime technology developed during the war, again, at public expense. Furthermore, when transistors were developed, there was nothing much to do with them. So the government stepped in, meaning you stepped in, or your parents, or whatever, and paid for transistor research and development. The government procurement was the total use of transistors in the early crucial years when the research and designs and production techniques and so on were developed. In fact, 10 years after they were invented, the Western Electric Company, which is Bell's AT&T supplier, they were producing, I think, a couple hundred thousand transistors, and 100% of them were for the government market. So that's the one example which maybe rises to the level of a joke of the miracles of the market and consumer choice. These are the Saintly Allens examples. I didn't pick them. But in fact, again, as even the most ignorant economist must know, certainly the business world knows, just about every dynamic sector of the U.S. economy works that way, whether it's electronics or pharmaceuticals or biotechnology or whatever. There's an enormous public component for the research and development stage and for absorption of risk. The story is that the way, you know, the miracles of the market are supposed to work, the cost and risk are socialized. They're the public's responsibility. There is a private component, namely profit and power are privatized. That's really existing markets. And it's not just the United States, it's every industrial society, and it's not new. It goes back to the origins of the Industrial Revolution. It's what you might call really existing market theory. These examples are good ones. Well, of course, the business world thinks this is a terrific arrangement. Why shouldn't they? When you look at particular cases, you get a clearer sense of the way it works. So take, say, the leaders of the conservative revolution in Congress. The leader in the House is Newt Gingrich, who's full of eloquent rhetoric about the work ethic and making sure people get off the cycle of dependency, and, you know, seven-year-old children have to know that nobody's going to give you a gift and that kind of business. He also, year after year, keeps the record for bringing federal subsidies to his rich constituents in Cobb County, Georgia, suburb of Atlanta. It happens to be a region where the state role in the economy, government role, meaning public role, is unusually extensive, but he's champion. Again, to be precise, he's third. Arlington, Virginia, which is part of Washington, gets more federal subsidies. That's where the Pentagon is and places like that. And Brevard County, Florida, which is the home of the Kennedy Space Center, that gets more public subsidies. But apart from them, Gingrich, year after year, is the record for suburban district. The main employer in his district is that noted exponent of free markets, Lockheed Martin, a publicly subsidized corporation. In fact, every American household, the average household, pays about a $200 a year Lockheed Martin tax to make sure that the rich folk down there don't break the cycle of dependency. Even with the public support, Lockheed went broke in the early 70s, so it was rescued by a $250 million bailout by the Nixon administration. It was that action that led Senator Proxmire to coin the phrase corporate welfare. Well, okay, that's the leader of the conservative revolution in the House. How about the leader in the Senate, Trent Lott, Senate Republican leader? I'll just quote the staid and quite proper Financial Times, the leading financial journal in the world from London, had a headline reading, "Most Successful Pork Producer of 1997. Then goes on to the story about Trent Lott. It continues like this. If you take, say, the CEO of Citicorp, Walter Wriston, the man who more or less invented huge loans to the third world, which led to the third world debt crisis and so on. He's a great exponent of the free market and laissez-faire, and very proud of the fact that markets can now set social policy. They're so powerful, so you don't have to worry about democratic states anymore. On the other hand, when the whole thing went bust in 1982, he was quite happy to be bailed out by the public. When the third world debts were socialized and the commercial banks were essentially paid off in various indirect ways by taxpayers, and of course by the victims who paid for it. So the laissez-faire doctrine disappeared. It's a little more to that story. Wriston's entrepreneurial techniques included, in fact, a large part of the bank's profits were based on fraudulent schemes worked out in Brazil, which were declared illegal by the Internal Revenue Service. But that was no big problem. The IRS was overruled by William Simon, another great believer in the free market. He was then Secretary of the Treasury, and he shortly after resigned and joined the board of directors of Citicorp. Well, that's the way the real world works. On the other hand, there's the picture world that you're taught about. As I say, there's nothing really new about this, but there are changes. It goes way back in the beginning of American history and England before it. But there have been changes. There was a major change around the Second World War, the Depression and the Second World War. The Depression of the 1930s made it very clear to anyone who had any lingering illusions about the matter that there's no conceivable possibility for free market capitalism to work. I mean, nobody really believed it much anyway, but that put an end to it. The New Deal measures took some of the edge off the depression, but not very much. I mean, they made people feel better and that sort of thing, but the effects were about the same. There was not much difference in 1939 and 1929. What did cure the depression was the war. The war created a command economy, or a semi-command economy. Market principles were put to the side. Corporate executives flocked to Washington and organized a state-controlled economy, which was extremely successful. American industrial production tripled, depression over, resources were allocated, wages and prices, mainly wages, were controlled, and it was extremely effective, and it taught lessons. In particular, it taught lessons to the guys who ran the economy. They didn't have to read about Keynes in textbooks, they had just seen it. Here was a organized state-controlled economy which had plenty of private profit. So Boeing Corporation, for example, took off, you know, doing its patriotic duty by making huge profits after it barely survived before. But the lesson was very clear and it was understood. It was assumed almost universally by businessmen, by economists and others, that the country is going to sink right back into recession after the war, unless the government stepped in. And if you read, go back and read the business press in those days, you know, Fortune, Business Week and so on, they were pretty frank about it. So Fortune explained that high-tech industry, I'm quoting, cannot, they were talking about aeronautical industry, but then they generalized to all high-tech industry, cannot survive in a competitive, unsubsidized, free enterprise economy.
Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and so much more, well-known political critic, America's leading dissident, speaking at Purdue University in Indiana just a few weeks ago. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. As we reported earlier in the show, up to 20 people were reported killed today in Indonesia as thousands of students and others continue massive nationwide protests against the dictator Suharto. Indonesia has sent armored personnel carriers into the streets of the capital today. The U.S. Embassy has urged American citizens to defer non-essential travel to Indonesia and is evacuating family members of embassy staff. Japan and France also caution their citizens to stay away. Witnesses said five men were wounded by gunfire. Others said they saw two men shot to death and three others injured in one downtown street. We're now going to turn to an interview I did late yesterday afternoon at the United Nations with a pro-democracy activist from Indonesia who had just made it to the United States. He had been tortured in Indonesia, escaped through the Netherlands. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, you've just listened to Noam Chomsky giving a speech. Noam Chomsky, who has long talked about another issue as well, and that is the story of Indonesia and Indonesian-occupied East Timor. On Monday on Democracy Now!, we played the testimony of Indonesian democracy activist Pius Lustrulanang, testimony he gave before Congress last Thursday. Well, he joins me now. He's come to New York, spoken at the United Nations. And the reason we're having him on again is to respond to the latest news, which is that at least six students have been killed in Jakarta this week. They were demonstrating at a private university, and it looks like the Indonesian military opened fire on them. We welcome you, Pius Lustrulanang, to Democracy Now!
Yeah, hi. Pius Lusterlanang is the coordinator of SIAGA, the People's Democratic Alliance in Indonesia, which is a coalition supporting the opposition leaders Megawati Sukarno-Putri and Amin Rais. What is your response to the soldiers killing the students? Did this come as a surprise to you?
No, because before he did to the student, they have been that before to other people.
These students, can you describe the university that they are at and who they are?
The university, you mean? Trisakti University is situated in Jakarta near Toll Road. It's a very well-known university, private university, and most of the students came from middle and upper class. And it's really hard to imagine that it can a demonstration, a very radical demonstration, can take place on the very stable university.
And I assume also surprising that the Indonesian soldiers would shoot these wealthier students.
Yes, but I know that sooner or later the military will take more firm action, and because they think that according to their experience, they think that they can effectively
squelch
the demonstration by shooting. They have no other methods. They usually use that method as a lethal weapon.
As a lethal weapon. Pius, you yourself have been subject to the brutality of the Indonesian military. Can you describe what happened to you in February?
Yes, I was abducted at gunpoint and then taken by car into a place I couldn't identify till now. I was handcuffed and blindfolded, and I was tortured while interrogating. I was given electric shock, beat and kick, and sometimes they push my head down into the water in order to get some information for me. But the worst is the first 3 days, and after that they only take me into the jail but isolated me from outside world, so no one can know where am I and is I still alive or not.
How long were you held like this?
How long? For 2 months.
Do you know who these abductors were, who these men who tortured you were?
I do not know, but from some indicators, I can conclude that it must be military. But I could not describe from what unit they came from. The indicators are the guns. I saw 3 guns during the abducted. In Indonesia, the institution who monopolizes a gun is military. The private person cannot owning a gun. And I also heard sound of trumpet as for a roll call. Mm-hmm. Yes, the clearest evidence is was on the day of my release, on the morning of 3 April. One of the officers revealed that he was an Akabri. Akabri is Armed Forces Academy.
One of the officers revealed that he was Abri, the Indonesian Armed Forces?
Yes, he was Akabri graduate. And actually, he was the one who gave me a final dose of electric shock before my release. He said as a token of remembrance.
Did the people who abducted you threaten you, saying you should not speak about what happened to you once you were released?
Yes. They threatened me that they will execute me if I say the truth or if I hold some if I hold press conference.
Yet you did.
Yeah, because I know that it have to be stopped. There have to be no more kidnappings. But the only way to stop this is only by let the world know what happened. By speak out, I mean.
We're talking to Pius Lusterlanang, who is an Indonesian democracy activist, coordinator of the People's Democratic Alliance in Indonesia, which is a coalition supporting Indonesia's main opposition leaders. He was abducted and remained missing for 2 months while enduring detention and torture. He was the first recently disappeared Indonesian activist to go public with his experience. After your press conference, you went to the Netherlands. You then came to the United States and testified before the U.S. Congress. Here in the United States, the Clinton administration continues to support the Suharto regime. The Pentagon, because of being embarrassed by recent revelations in The Nation magazine by journalist Alan Nairn that secret military trainings were going on of Indonesian soldiers, have announced that they've suspended those trainings of these special forces troops who are known for their brutality, but they have yet to cancel them outright. What does that connection mean between the U.S. military and the Indonesian soldiers, that training? What does it mean to you as an Indonesian pro-democracy activist?
It means that the United States is providing a training to the troops that have been shown that often be shown as suppressive elements of pro-democracy. Yeah. We have a long record that the army always take a part in violence, and the violence of human rights, there always be a military role in it.
Do you have a message for President Clinton?
Yes, I do. I think he must reconsider its initial policy toward Indonesia, because changing are happening in Indonesia now. Suharto will no longer exist in the near future. There will be some kind of democratic system in Indonesia. So it means that maybe from now on he should give much more support to democratic element.
U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, after the killings of the students, said that the U.S. supports political reform in Indonesia. How do the students feel in Indonesia about political reform?
The students of political reform as at least have to include succession, presidential succession. It means that Suharto have to be stepped down.
So you're saying that political reform in the students' eyes must include the Suharto stepping down?
Yes. Without Suharto stepping down, they believe that there will be no political reform.
Pius, I know that you, as a student, were one of the organizers of a demonstration after the Santa Cruz massacre in East Timor in 1991, in which the Indonesian soldiers opened fire and killed more than 250 Timorese. Why did you, as an Indonesian student, get involved in the protests over killings in Indonesian-occupied East Timor?
First, I do not. I cannot accept that the very brutal violence is using to the non-violence movement. I cannot accept that the non-armed young people who express their willings for freedoms are hidden by real ballot. It's a criminal for humanity. I cannot accept that because I believe that as an ex-colonial colonialized nation, we have expressed that the self-determination is the right of every nation.
What happened to you after you protested the Santa Cruz massacre of 1991?
The police and the military arrest me and 10 other students for 24 hours and then release.
How does the movement for self-determination for the people of East Timor fit into the pro-democracy movement in Indonesia? How do the students feel about it?
The students feel that the self-determination and the success of the struggle of East Timor has tight relationship with the success of pro-democracy movement in Indonesia.
Why?
Because by bring about the democratic systems, it can let the other people, the people, to decide what the best for the future on their own.
What do you think will happen in Indonesia in the next few weeks, in the next few months?
More clashes between army and students, and it seems that the students are and the people are determined that they will not stop.
They're determined?
Yeah, determined not to stop demonstrating until Suharto step down. No. They don't care that the military is still side with Suharto.
Do you think people in the United States can make a difference in helping the people of Indonesia?
I think they can do much role in convince their government to support the democracy, because they seen their self, their nations, as prominent proponents of democracy and human rights in the world.
Well, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Now, P.S. Lustralanang has been our guest, coordinator of the People's Democratic Alliance in Indonesia. He's here for just a week. Well, that does it for today's show. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill, our technical director, Errol Maitland. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!